Welcome to What Makes a Hop American and Where American Hops Are Headed. From not only Stan Hieronymus, who I think all of us knows more about hops and beers than just about anybody. I'm Doug Piper, and I am the host and founder of Gourmet Brewing. Check it out sometime. I talk to cool people just like Stan, and Stan's been on there more than once. I am part of the AHA Governing Committee, and I appreciate those of you that voted for me and those of you that didn't. That's okay. You get stuck with me anyway. But I consider the AHA your AHA, and as a newbie on the committee, I really, I'm a sponge. So please talk to me. Let me know if there's something I can do to help, or maybe more importantly, what we can do to influence the 2023 HomebrewCon, because there's a lot of new energy in the governing committee, and we want to hear what you guys have to say. Before we get started, I think everybody is very compliant, is already taking their seats, so thank you for that. I don't think we have to worry about moving to the center of the aisles, but if you do see a rush come in, that would be appreciated. Ask you to silence your phones, so I'm going to fake it here, but since I'm reading the script here, I'm not going to actually turn off mine, but if you would turn off yours, that would be appreciated. Test. Is it okay? Okay. That's a good segue. So right over there is a microphone. If you haven't figured it out yet, we really like to use the microphones, and it's not because the rest of the people in the room can't hear. These will be recorded and will be in the archive, and I think if I hit the button here, that's the QR code where you can watch all of the previous homebrew cons. If you don't come up to the microphone when we replay this, your question will not be heard by those in the future who want to hear your question. So don't do it for the room. Do it for somebody else that wants to hear your question in the future. So use the mics there. That would be appreciated. And let's see, we've already talked about the recorded ones and the QR codes. That survey, which I've touched on, but it's worth mentioning again. Please fill those out, because the AHA committees and newbies like me are anxious to see what they are. So take the time, and I've already heard several people. Jerry was talking about he had an observation on the app he was going to put in there. Please do that. And even if you've told me, also put it in the survey, because it counts twice as much. They go, oh, well, that's what Doug heard. But then they go and see it in the app. They go, 2 points. Yes. Okay, it's in your app at the end of each. So when you go to Stan's thing, you'll see it right in there. Thank you. That's the best kind of question. So one of my favorite people in brewing is Stan Hieronymus. He is a fan of Native Land IPA, which is a national collaboration beer that used a recipe created by Bow and Arrow Brewing in New Mexico. And I guess you're going to share more about that, aren't you?
No, that was this morning.
That was this morning.
You can say, because you've got the smoke, so they can go online and see the presentation they slept through this morning.
All right. Stan is the 2015 recipient of the American Homebrewers Association Governing Committee Recognition Award, and also the author of not one, two, three, but actually four books, including Brewing Local American Grown Beer. I love that title. Stan was one of the founding speakers of Gourmet Brewing, and he recently shared that he had a beer score of 16 at the New Mexico State Fair and then won the best of show the next year.
Same beer.
Nope. Okay, so.
Interesting judging, don't you think?
So if you're upset with the scoring this year, just try again next year, because Stan has proven its diligence is worthwhile. So, with that, Stan, thank you so much.
look forward
Thank
to
you.
It.
It's so real quickly, I'm bottling beer to enter for the competition, and I'm bottling this Imperial Stout, and my wife says it's really good. Of course, it needed a bottle condition, and I did not realize that when I put the beer in that it would spend the next 2 weeks in cold storage and then be judged. So the judges referred to it. They said, this is, you need to get better at making extract beers. It was a really nice Imperial Stout. It got 46, I think, in the first round at NHC the next year and won Best of Show. But it does show you should probably taste the beers right before you enter them. Don't count on. Or the other part, which I would never say, is occasionally my wife's advice is not perfect. But she's a Jeopardy champion, and she's usually right. Anyway, since Providence, the only news is I moved to Colorado. And those are the four books. I already signed those. You show up this late in the day, you miss everything. So let's start right out. We're going to talk about what makes a hop American. This is the breeding for Citra hop. A key player here in this chart would get much bigger is, you can see at the top, 63015 male. That has a lot of other hops in it. Bavaria, East Kent Golding, and most important, Brewer's Gold, which we're going to talk about. So that cross is made in 1984. That produces a male on the right and Hallertau Middle Fruit on the left. And they're crossed in 1990 as part of a hop a breeding program at Hopsteiner. It was funded by a large brewery who is not named, but is probably in England. And they fund that, and they get about 50 different hops that are interesting. They brew beer with them and stuff like that, and that brewery abandons the project. They're not interested in any hops. They actually had Citra in hand in 1992. It goes back. The breeder, Gene Probasco, keeps the hop on the side, keeps those hills on the side. Another brewery, and I have no idea what brewery that is, comes to him and says, we're looking for a new hop variety that has a sort of spiciness to it. And so he says, you'll really like this hop. So they fund more. They go out to more hills. They try the hop, and they say, don't care for it, and abandon it. So now it's the early aughts, and he's going to a conference with a hop chemist from Miller, and who says, we're looking for a new hop variety. He says, I've got just a thing for you. And they begin trialing it. They made a double IPA called Pat Ting. He's the chemist. Pat Ting's double IPA, small batches. He loved it. It was sort of back and forth. Do we like this hop or not? Miller could own this hop, but they didn't particularly like it. Now it goes in the hands of Sierra Nevada, Deschutes, and I think it's Odell, who help fund the hop, take it out to 5 acres, and it's Widmer, and Widmer makes a pale ale with this hop in 2008 and wins a gold medal at the World Beer Cup, at which point they gave it a name and it goes into everybody else's hands. So it shows you how hard it is for a hop to prove itself. But the other part of this is you can see the percentage in the pedigree. So this hop is 50% Middle Fruit, 25% U.S. Tet, which is actually Fugl. So again, that's a land race European hop. 19% Brewer's Gold, and we're going to talk about Brewer's Gold, and which means that Brewer's Gold is half British and half American. So that's 9.5, and then you got more. You got the East Kent Golding, and then there's 3% unknown. And if we guess, that's all American. The most this hop is 1/8 American. The rest of the heritage is UK or European. Yet it has all this characteristic that you don't ever get in any of those hop varieties. So we'll start with the idea, as I said. Hops begin about 6 million years ago in Mongolia. About a million years ago, they move into Europe. And if I show the region, it actually goes down to Africa, up to Scandinavia. You have hops in all that area, and it sort of went like this and then up to there. About a half million years later, the hops go the other way into Japan and then over into North America. So they're younger, and we end up with five botanical varieties. And the ones you want to pay attention to are the lupulus, because those are the ones of European heritage, lupuloides, which are in North America, neomexicanus, who you probably, they've got a little bit of buzz around them, so you've heard of some of those pure neomexicanus hops. What they discovered early on, like 500 years ago, when they're growing hops in the Czech Republic and in Germany, is they do not grow true to seed. That means you can't let the seeds drop to the ground or collect seeds, plant them, and get the same plant. It changes every time. They're like people. So you can see here, these are sisters from one planting. So in other words, those seeds, there's a cross made, and you'll get about 1,000 to begin with, and they're all unique. So these go in the field, and these are Hopsteiner experimental hops, but they are immediately different. So we refer to landrace varieties rather than, quote, noble hops. And basically what the farmers were saying is, we like the hop that grows on this side of the road. We're not so happy with the hop that grows on that side of the road. And they understood that they need to clone those hops, which you're taking from rhizomes. You can also clone them actually from leaf material. So basically those landrace hops that were just picked over time, so they breed naturally with each other, but at a point in time, both growers and brewers said, this is what we want. We want to freeze that in time. So we end up with Fuggel and Golden in England, Tettnanger Spalter and Hallertau Mittelfru in Germany, and Saaz from Bohemia. About 20 years ago, Sam Adams confused things because they made a noble hop pills, and they put Hersbrucker in it. So they called Hersbrucker a noble hop. I'm sort of fine with that, but generally the scientists don't consider that part of that family. So in the aughts, researchers in the Czech Republic and Canada went and collected wild hops and cultivars from Canada, from the U.S., then throughout Europe, and importantly from Caucasia, because Caucasia, when they showed you that that hop they were taking, the hops were taking, it passed through Caucasia. So you can see how they changed, how they remained the same. So you can look at the, there are two things to look at here, and I'll show you this chart again when we talk about the U.S., is the alpha acids. Look at the difference between U.S. wild and Caucasian wild or European wild. Much more alpha, and the variation, so that's plus or minus. This chart would be really messy to read otherwise. And important, Doug said that there'll be more intense data things here. You can download this through the site or email me, and I'll send you this presentation. But you can see this variation, like in, once you cross them, U.S. cultivars can be plus or minus on the alpha, and the beta would be the same way, and the cohumulone is considerably different as well, and the total oil. So just as a native hop, the Americans are different, which makes them more useful and diverse in breeding. Pardon me one second. So to return to that map before, well, then the Europeans, and particularly the British, when they came to the U.S., they brought their own hops with them. So that's why I kept that one yellow. Well, what happens as soon as that's hop in the field, then you had a natural crossing of hops. So now you've got, they put a female plant in the field. You've got other males around that are going to pollinate them. They are, if you're not paying attention, those seeds go on the ground. You get a new hop variety, which maybe you like better than the original. The most prominent of those was one called English Golding, or English Cluster, which may have been a Golding or a Fuggel, mostly likely related to Golding. But that goes in the ground, it's crossed with American males, and eventually you have the hop, which you can buy today, called Cluster. but its origin isn't exactly well known. It is high in cohumulon, for instance, indicating that it's American heritage. So by the early 19th century, particularly in the UK, a little bit more in Europe, they're importing American hops because they have better keeping power. So you can use them in the boils, you understand. So you might not be in love with CTZ, for instance, but it works really effectively to give you bitterness at the outset. For those of you who remember when we used to have bitter IPAs. So you can see this is from the Edinburgh Review in 1862, and pointing out that American hops may be dismissed in a few words. Like American grapes, they derive a coarse, rank flavor and smell from the soil in which they grow, which no management, however careful, has hitherto succeeded in neutralizing. There is little chance of them competing with our markets with European growth. It was an undesirable smell. The American aspect sucked. What they're bringing in, something like cluster. But always with that American background. So there's Canadian vine was planted some of the time. But basically, it was that cross. There was no reason to bring back an English hop that had been in the UK from the U.S. They were not importing anything for aroma. They were importing it for... And so for the recording, the question is, what varieties did they bring in? So what we introduce is the flavor of Manitoba. And this is E.S. Salmon, who was a pretty good tennis player, apparently had a great pornography collection. And as important as anything, he held out in plant breeding that two parts. He was following Gregor Mendel, and that's who introduces the idea that you've got dominant characteristics, and you want to put two dominants together. So that part of breeding, which was different than, say, Darwin talked about, which was more averaging, and obviously Darwin was not correct. But at the time, when this is right at the outset of the 20th century, any breeding programs operated on the assumption that hops were basically the same. What made them different was where they grew. And he held out that there was something different. Like he says, and all our books tell us that the varieties of hops cultivated over the world have all arisen from one species, Humulus lupulus. I am convinced that is not the case. So he set out to bring in hops. Oops, I did that wrong. Sorry about that. From North America. He collected hops from the South, and those are clearly Neo-Mexicanus. And he also collected hops from up in Canada, and those were likely lupuloides. And they do have some differences, which are important as breeders start to sort those out as they're going to create the new hops that your children are going to use. So he started bringing those in like 1908, 1909. But the key hop was one he collected in, or he had collected for him in Manitoba, and that's probably a lupuloides, but we'll talk about that momentarily. And he puts that hop in the field. It is open-pollinated, so it's probably a Golding or Fuggle father with a clearly American female. And you get thousands of seeds, plants them. Unfortunately, BB1, which is the mother from Manitoba, dies, so we can't go back and see what that was and what it was like. One of the hops that comes out of that, actually two hops you know the name of, one is Brewer's Gold, and the other is Bullion. And so then they begin evaluating, and they take these to the British breweries, and you can see that same sort of thing, that the feedback is not exactly positive. They refer to the pungent Manitoba flavor, that they're too bitter, too rank, and slightly unpleasant. They are stronger scented, and they have a tang which American varieties impart. And you'll see that evaluation from other brewers. They don't like that American tang. And, of course, that American Tang is now what you're tasting in popular IPAs. This was, for hundreds of years, that was bad. And then all of a sudden, like in 1976, it was okay. So there's a matter of genotypes, phenotypes. This is a family tree. So if you're at all interested, and particularly since you're in the East Coast, Ales Through the Ages, and Travis will hold up his hand here. And back by Travis, there are brochures. And back that corner are brochures for Ales Through the Ages. And this is research that's going on right now at the University of Minnesota. So there are 118 cultivars that are all offspring of Brewer's Gold, so which is not great for diversity. And this is something I'm going to talk more about when Josh finishes his research and what that means. So Citra is right down in here. We're not showing the whole Citra family tree. We're only showing what comes from BB1, for instance. This is mostly interest to me, but I hope it's a little bit interesting to you. Was Brewer's Gold Lupuloides or Neomexicanus? And this becomes important. A hop like Sabro is the daughter of a Neomexicanus mother. We know that. So what makes Sabro so different? Because it is very different. And then, of course, you may have messed around with Medusa, which is an all Neomexicanus hop, but it's different varieties of Neomexicanus bred together. And then Zappa's now enough acreage that at the homebrew level you should be able to get what you want of it and use it. And again, it's all Neomexicanus. So I asked Peter Darby, who just recently retired, and he was the hop breeder in the UK, so he has all the records from Salmon. He took over from Salmon. Like I said, you can download and read this at your leisure later. He suggested, it appears to him that BB1 probably has both Lupuloides and New Mexicanus in its background. And as he says, I think the evidence suggests that BB1 was predominantly Lupuloides, but perhaps with a little New Mexicanus in the parentage. And a reason this interests me is I don't like anything that gets too much buzz. So I got to say there's something wrong with it. So Neomexicanus is getting all this attention. I'm going, whoa, back up. Let's be careful what we're doing moving forward. So phenotypes is what you're interested in, which is what are the characteristics, because then you know what you're breeding with. And when we talk about when a hop is American versus a landrace hop in Europe, that's what characters does it have. And an important part of this is some of its genotype, but also the terroir of the hops, where it is grown, how that can change it. And terroir is real. We kind of back off from a beer standpoint because the wine people have been using that word for a long time, and we think that's just some sort of made-up thing to make wine more expensive. And it might be. And the matter of terroir is it's a combination of environment and epigenetics. And I don't know if you're familiar with epigenetics. There's a lot of study of that right now for humans because you're trying to figure out a way to not pass on things like genes that leave you predisposed for cancer. They make hops from a particular area unique. All plant species have what's known as methylated DNA. And what happens is it can be switched on or off, depending where it grows. Even more terrifying is if you're taking a cutting from a rhizome in a stress situation, you may be actually not replicating that same plant. And there are differences, say, in soil, day length, the big difference for the hops, the temperatures, the amount of rainfall, the terrain they're in, everything influences that. The underlying DNA does not change, but the methylation pattern may be different. To give you an example, so these are charts from John I. Haas. They're Saz and Tettnanger. Saz and Tettnanger are genetically identical, but in the Tettnang region, they get more rain, they get more days of sunlight, they're at a different altitude, and they also grow their binds to 8 meters, they grow them to 7 meters in size, and the spacing between the rows is different. All these create differences. So you can look here at, I guess I got to do it like this. So in the Tettnanger here, like the citrus, a bunch more than size. Meanwhile, the spicy size, a bunch more than the Tettnanger. And that's based upon where they grow. Now, if they had done this with a different lot of Tettnanger, it would look a little bit different because it really depends where you are in Tettnang. And this is, I think, a better example. I just wish they had more. And I say, boy, this is tiny. I don't know if you can read those there or not. What we have is a combination. These two are German, and then you've got in the UK. And they've only used one American, which is ludicrous when we're doing this. This is all Cascade. But you can see the differences from region to region. And there would be at least that much difference between Oregon Cascade and Washington Cascade and Idaho Cascade, New York Cascade, Michigan Cascade. They're all different. And that this is the same. If you took a rhizome from here and grew it here, it would begin to look like that. Genetically, it remains the same. It depends upon where it's growing. So that's another thing that is a factor in making the American hops different. If you want a softer, because actually in Belgium they still grow Brewer's Gold, as opposed that there are only like two farms, now three farms in Yakima that grow Brewer's Gold. If you want a Brewer's Gold that is softer and not as expressive, then you would get the one from Belgium. To me, it'll be interesting because CLS Farms is now starting to grow some with the idea. It's a project that Vinny Ceruso is starting at Russian River to see what you can get out of Brewer's Gold, do collaborations with other brewers and things like that. That might be fun to talk about next year. So really when we talk about American hops, I'd like this. This is from an Italian winemaker. But like he says, and first of all, this is actually Barthas. These are the German hop growers who appreciate that you have this new trend towards super tropical, juicy hops. They understand they want to sell those. They're selling American hops. They're breeding a few hops in Germany. But if you messed around with Huelmelon, you know that they're really not that expressive. Hallertau Blanc, really nice hop, but it's not expressing anything like, say, Citra or whatever. But anyway, as this winemaker said, he says, I will only say, there's a typo, sorry, that Americans like too much in the glass. There's always too much going on. Other than that, if we're living in planet America, it's not necessarily the fault of Americans. But to go back to the other thing, too much in the glass, I judged 4 rounds of IPAs this week, and 80% of them had too much in the glass. So back to just looking again, so you can see this difference. It's not as important as, that, say, the U.S. wild, but the U.S. cultivars and what they refer to as mixed cultivars, because both of those, when they say U.S. cultivar, they still have European hops in them. They are much, much more alpha. When you have more alpha, naturally, you're going to have more total oil. And ultimately, that brings us to what you're interested in right now, which is the oil, because that's what gives you the aroma and the flavor. So shortly after Citra was released, two sets of research in Japan. One began looking at thiols and 4-MMP. which are in Citra, and Summit, and now Mosaic, Equinaut, and so on. Almost any new hop variety is probably going to have free thiols. I'm not going to talk, I'll bring those up. I hope you have an idea about biotransformation thiols. That's a whole nother presentation. But what they also noticed is that some of the oil compounds were the same in coriander and in Citra. So they brewed a beer with coriander and with Citra and compared the two, and they had much of, so they're creating citronellal. The citronellal is an only small amount in the raw hop, but then you would get this transformation, created citronellal, which, as well as being deterrent to mosquitoes, also has this real lime in the beginning of more citrus character. And then they did the research, which hops have more of the geraniol, which will be converted in the citronellal, and that's why they come up with the chart, and their thinking is they're looking for hops rich in linalool and geraniol. The problem with that is you can see, and this is in brewed beer, so you can see Bravo, in brewed beer, you get lots of linalool, lots of citronellal, lots of geraniol. Cascade pretty good at that, more than Citra or Mosaic. But look at the bottom part of this graph here, and these are much more tropical. So you ask yourself, what's missing? So the first step is, this is the easy biotransformation when you create new compounds that add some fruitiness. A lot of confusion when you use the word biotransformation. There are four different biotransformations going on. We're interested in this, in this case, the conversion of monoterpenes. Later on, there's this idea, and the hardest one is freeing bound thiols, which we're not really going to mess with here. That's going to take either enzymes or different yeast. There are free thiols as well, so it's easiest thing to do, identify which hops have the free thiols and use those. That'd be another presentation if you want to talk about freeing bound thiols. So these same researchers in Dr. Takoi's research department at Sapporo? Yeah, Sapporo. He then looks, they're going, what's missing? So these are actually just raw compounds, not hops made with those. So they're taking, and this is what they refer to as the linalool geraniol citronellal mix. And you can see on the raw, you're getting all that fruitiness. And then meanwhile, one of these compounds, 4-MMP, which is not as prominent as 3-MH, but it is in Citra, it is in Mosaic, and it's sort of tropical. You mix the two together, and kaboom. Now you've got what people are fall in love with fruity tropical bombs. This is not biotransformation. This is, you know, what happens when you put them together. This is synergy. Synergy is as important as biotransformation. It's a shorter word, too, so I don't know why people... So when we talk about American characteristics, and this is just the way we describe them, but I put Sabro there. Again, this is from that same Haas thing. You can see it's just big, boom. Where it's big, particularly coconut. They have higher alpha acids. They have higher alpha-beta ratio. So when you're thinking about making lagers, those Landrace hops work better because when you have a lower alpha-to-beta ratio, you get a more pleasant bitterness. So if you're using a hop, say, Laurel, which has a wonderful aroma and that nice lemon character, it's a made-up word meaning lemon floral. One problem with those hops is the alpha to beta is like 2.5 to 1. And if you turn around and you're swapping that in for say, your Saaz or middle fruit, which are going to be less than 1 to 1, they have more essential oil. Much of that's myrcene, and you don't care about myrcene, but they have the other stuff. More monoterpenes, and particularly the geraniol. If you're looking for markers, geraniol gets you along the way. They get more thiols, they might be free, they might be bound. So when we talk about what's American, we're also talking about Australia and New Zealand. Australia used Cluster, which is with the American Heritage, and Brewer's Gold for much of its breeding program and the base beer, the base hops, a lot of the males that they're used in the breeding. In New Zealand, several varieties are the offspring of Cluster, including Nelson Sauvin. So meanwhile, in Germany, so backing up, their climate in Australia and New Zealand is more like the American Northwest. It's drier. It's certainly a lot. It's influenced less, in the case of the UK, by all the how close they are to the ocean. But you do get in Germany, you get Mandarina Bavaria, Huelmellen, Hallertau Blanc, a new hop called Tango. They're all children of Cascade. So Cascade becomes more important going in the future. Cascade is not an offspring of Brewer's Gold. The other plus to that gives you more genetic diversity. In England, all these, they start with Cascade, and you get Jester, Godiva, Harlequin, Oceana, and a bunch of other ones there. They like the New World character. If you're a English brewer, I think there are good reasons to use this because it becomes a local hop. It has a certain amount of character. It is not as bold as new varieties coming out of the United States. So for you as home brewers, I'm not sure why you would mess with them, quite honestly. In France, Mistral and Elixir are both daughters of Cascade. And Elixir, for instance, is actually in Pliny the Younger. So it's showing up some pretty good places. So your reward for listening to me talk about agronomy and history is some of the new varieties. So talking about the future, this is the immediate future. So some new hops out there. Vista is from the USDA public program, and it's got some tropical fruity character. And because it's in the public program, it means it's probably not going to be as expensive. So how many of you try and grow your own hops at home a little bit? You can grow Vista. You can't grow Citra. Luminosa, that's a new one. There's about 30 acres this year, and it's grown in Oregon, and it comes out of a program funded by Indy Hops. And the fun thing about that is it's a daughter of Sirachi Ace. It gives you a lot of the same, that lemony blast, really interesting of Sirachi Ace. And somehow they discarded the dill, and that's magic. ADHA 1624 that's another breeding program, and it's got this berry green mango, bit of pine, bit of dank. That's the same program that gave you Azaka. Azaka was a Homebrewers Association giveaway hop last year, if you got any of that, and it's still growing in popularity. Kind of right now, I think it's an opportunity to get that and make your beer a little bit different because not that many people are using it. HBC 630 may or may not ever get a name. It may. So the hop breeding company program gave you Citra, then in 2012 Mosaic, in 2014 Equinot, in 2016 Laurel, in 2018 Sabro, in 2020, Talus. So you can see these are all the hops that are getting a lot of attention, a lot of buzz. In 2020, before harvest, they will be naming a hop. Outside chance, it could be the HBC 630, which has this really cherry-like and a raspberry note too, or it just may remain a specialty hop used on the side. Best bet is they're going to name 586. Which just has all this mango and guava and lychee. One hop I didn't put on there, which I should have, is 1019, which for some reason people are excited, but they describe it as rummy. I've had a couple beers with it. They weren't rummy, but it's really nice, bright hop, but that's more likely a 2024 or 2026 hop. HS 17701 is a hop. When you're done here, if you go downstairs to the Hopsteiner booth, you can taste a beer with that hop in it. And this is where we segue to the future and stuff you might think you're not interested in, but you better be interested in it, and that's the environmental future of hops in a time of global warming. So 17701 is a really good yielding hop, so that's important. And I don't, Citra is a great hop, but Citra yields a less than 1,600 pounds per acre. 17701, on the other hand, is going to yield more like 3,200 pounds per acre. You're using the same amount of resources and getting twice the number of hops. That's water. It's also the program at Hopsteiner is their hops are more disease resistant, so you don't have to spray them as much. Saves money, also maybe saves your life. It's hard to save. In Europe, their farm to fork program is it's going to be much harder to sell American hops because they are really concerned about residual what's the residuals left in green matter. And 17701's interesting. It gives you a lot of tropical and stuff like that. And an intriguing part, and you can see where breeders are going now, is it has 62% other. So there are eight big, so which you see when hops are listed, myrcene, caryophyllene, humulene, farnesene, then linalool, geraniol, limonene, and citronellyl is always measured, even though it's almost never there in the hop. 62% is coming in something else. Most of the hops we are looking at here, they're more, that just the myrcene alone is more than 40%. So you see you're getting different compounds. That gives you something different where everything isn't the same. After a while, I'm pretty sure people will get bored with Citra, but we're not there yet. Another hop from Hopsteiner is called Helios, and you'll see that on the board downstairs with them. That's only important for its alpha. That's what they just want to get alpha out of it, and you don't really care too much about alpha. But again, that one can get pushing 4,000 pounds per acre, and it's 20 alpha. That's converted into CO2 extract, and large breweries around the world buy lots of that. They buy lots and lots of hops and then make 8BU beer with them. So looking in the future, one thing that moves things forward is next-generation sequencing. Already, the reason Hopsteiner is able to, like Helios, is both downy, mildew-resistant, and powdery mildew-resistant. Those are both super important, really cut down on your spraying, and they've done that because they found molecular markers. And the first molecular markers in hops were only identified in 1995. 4 years later, there were 224. Today, there are more than 1 million. Those have been identified. That doesn't mean we know exactly what they do. That's the next step, which is ongoing. There's a paper in the works that basically looks at the genome of the Cascade hop. But even when we sort that out, after we can match the markers and desirable traits, is the other thing that makes hops a bit of a problem is that they do not always replicate. They're a little kinky sexually. And as a matter of fact, the research that Hopsteiner's done, they got a video where it shows you, and this is what you would expect to happen right here, and it doesn't. So some hops just don't replicate themselves immediately. So you not only have to identify everything, you have to identify if this is a good plant to use in the course of a breeding program.
Would you replicate it in front of a camera?
That's such a personal question. So I want to leave some time. We're close to 15. For questions. So most of this. So I asked three hop breeders what they see. I said 15 years down the road. What you're really saying in that case, what they're breeding right now, because it takes 15 years to bring a hop, that is shortening. And just a few of the highlights of that would be. So Sean Townsend, he's the breeder at Oregon State University that Indy Hops funds. And as he said, he can see being more specialized hops. So where you're thinking which is a plus to being homebrewers. You can just skip all over the place. You don't have a brand that you've got to defend and say, this needs to be the same year after year. You can pick out things and say, I want to get a highlight flavor out of it. You know, something like Luminoso, which is he actually brings up, where you've got backbone hops and then you've got more boutique hops. For instance, Firestone Walker, you know, they'll often say they're doing a new beer. They're going to build it around something they know very well and then supplement it from that, because they can't bring out a new brand with a hop that isn't grown a lot of it, obviously. Then the agronomic characteristics, which we'll look at over time, it's getting warmer all the time. Last year in Yakima, they had a period of a week where the heat dome set in and the temperatures were about 115 degrees, and several hops just quit growing. They got halfway up, and then they're going, nah, that's it, I'm done. Citrus babies suffered terribly, and there was a lot of concern. If that heat dome had come 2 weeks later, harvest would have been a lot worse. It had time, the hops had time to recover, but it was pretty iffy for a while. And like he said, they're always playing whack-a-mole, so you're looking for hops that are pest-resistant, and that's going to change over time as well. So from Josh Havel, who's did that chart, and he's breeding hops in Minnesota. And he really thinks climate change is important. But one thing he points out, there could be one plus: as it gets warmer, then downy mildew will have less of an impact. Right now, where he is in Minnesota, it's horrendous. So if it got warmer, that would be mitigated. But, of course, there would be other problems. So as we spread, right now you think of a hops as a Northwest, and it is. 97%+ of the hops are grown in the American Northwest. If they're grown in other regions, we're going to need to breed for those regions. Vista does much of that. Vista is proving itself in New York State and proving itself in Michigan. And before, that hops didn't do that when a public hop was released. And then, like he says, they're going to have to thrive under hyper-variable weather conditions. So a new breeder in only a second public hop breeding program now has two breeders. We were down to one breeder for a long time, and it basically was not supported. The program just wasn't supported hardly at all. Through the efforts of the Brewers Association, they've helped get funding. It's lobbying and also providing funding. And then what's called the Hop Quality Group, which is about 40 breweries who kick in money, they've got their own. They are funding some other hop breeding, but it's kind of in parallel with the public hop breeding program. And to give you an update, I talk with my hands a lot and this gets in the way. That we were talking about thiolysis as good a time as anything. In the future, what you're going to see in hops, how do you free bound thiols may not matter if you have hops with more free thiols. So that hop quality group, every hop they're moving forward, they've already measured, and they know that they have thiols. So you're going to get more hops like Citra and Mosaic right now. Now, in 8 years, maybe nobody cares about that. But right now, that's what's coming down the road. So Kayla Altendorf has come in, and she comes from a grass background, but starts in USDA, and she's really, in 2 years, turned a lot around where we're understanding. Some of the record-keeping is horrendous. That's why we have this chart. You're going, who's the mother of this? Here's a great hop. How did this happen? And the record-keeping is so bad, we don't know. So, like she says, marker-assisted selection or genomic selection will become more important. The time to develop, the idea, maybe shrink it down to 8 years instead of 13 years. And, of course, people want unique aroma. So talking about the future, when we say, oh, climate change is a problem, we have to have good agronomic hops. They can still have the aroma and the flavor that you want. Using water efficiently, again, super important. You know, you can talk to Steiner. Steiner is doing, if you go down there and drink 17701, they will be very happy to talk to you about their efforts to mitigate water use, harvest more efficiently, disease resistance, all those sorts of things. The solution they don't have right now, one of the what uses so much energy is drying the hops. So I don't know, you know, at this point, but as she points out, that basically they understand the cone morphologies. So in other words, the way the cone is formed might make it possible to dry it more efficiently. And then optical irrigation. So I'll finish up. I'm going to give the last word, well, to you guys when you ask questions, but to Peter Darby, the retired hop breeder in the UK. He's retired from his UK job. He still does freelancing with the French and the Czechs. So he's still creating new aromas and flavors because he thinks it's fun. And you look at this guy and you go, this is an English hop breeder. You know? As he says, choosing the mother and the father, all the creativity is in that stage. And this is important to me because you want to be creative on what you're brewing. And the same people giving you what you're going to work with, if they have that same sense of creativity, then it gives you more opportunities. And so talking to him about understanding genomics, that's where he says, this is still the same despite all the advances in sequencing of hop genes. It is still likely to be the case that there is a choice of parents carrying the genes of interest, and I doubt whether the sequencing will be so complete as to define all the myriad of features that makes one parent superior to the other. The experience and intuition of the breeder will still be needed to choose between several similar varieties. Making the same decisions you get to make all the time to make interesting beers. So then we have the parting gifts here. Like I said, you can download this. So you got a list of hops that are rich in geraniol or might have geraniol. We know a lot more about 4-MMP than we know about 3-MH, although 3-MH is just as important, particularly since it also helps create 3-MHA. Because the Germans looked at a bunch of varieties, generally you'll see a list and say, okay, here are ones with 3-MH, and you go, what about the others? Does it have 3-MH? Doesn't it? The 4-MMP list, they actually have a list of stuff that has none. So, you know, mark that off your list as a free thiol. Now, you could have the bound thiols. Like I said, at club night or whatever, you want to talk to me about bound thiols, I'd be happy to do that. You can take those home, download this. Oh, okay, I put it at the end. So the other way is you can email me, and then if you didn't find this too terribly boring, I have a free newsletter, free, nothing, that once a month called Hop Queries, and it'll put in new hop varieties and new discoveries about, certainly we talk about thiols and yeast meant to free thiols and a variety of things like that. Anything that amuses me. So I hope there are questions. Thank you.
Stan, first of all, thank you for your interesting talk. Second, sorry for the question. Third, you said that they are starting to breed for states like New York State or Ohio or whatever. Do we know, or is also the other documentation very bad? Because New York State and Ohio were once the big growing areas for hops in the U.S. when they were pushed out to the Northeast.
Right.
Do we know what they grew at that time? And this is a possibility to go back to that.
A lot of that was cluster. And you wouldn't want to go back to the hops that grew there before because they failed, basically. And so when I say they're brewing for those regions, they are, when they find it, right now they aren't identifying and say, this will grow better in New York, this will grow better in Michigan. But when they're trialing the hops, they're making sure they work in those regions. And certainly they're thinking about the disease that is more likely in those areas.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks, Dan. That's fantastic. First of all, if you're in this room and you're not currently getting Stan's newsletter, you're missing out because it's awesome. Every month I learn something new from Stan. Just two quick questions, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Has the definition of tang changed over time? Because we hear about these historic references to the American tang But when I think of tang, I think of a low-level sour. So
I don't – we'll call that the British definition of tang. So I think it's different. I'm not sure exactly what they meant. One time, actually, this came up in a discussion with somebody in the UK, and they said, no, this is – you say tang, this is what we mean. But to me, it also means if you're not careful with Motueka, your Motueka beer will taste like tang.
You mentioned the terroir in Australia and New Zealand being similar to the Pacific Northwest. Does that mean they're also heavily reliant on irrigation like they would be in Yakima?
Boy, that's a good. Definitely in Australia they're irrigating. I think in the Nelson. Yeah, or they will be as because there's a lot of expansion in New Zealand. So if you've thought how hard it is to get some New Zealand hops, that is totally changing.
And I guess sort of tied into that, I guess I have three questions, sorry.
Right.
Are there any native hops to the Southern Hemisphere that are different from the species that we were talking about today? Or is everything that's Southern Hemisphere transplants of existing
species? Yeah, no, the hops just never...
Never crossed that latitude.
Right, so they never grew there.
Okay, thanks.
So, sure.
So given the amount of time it takes for a new hop to become, you know, a product, how reactive can the hop growing world be to the trends, or is it really more that they find something cool that they like that maybe starts a new trend? Like, which way around does that go?
Well, you can look how hard it was for Citra to make it out, and that shows you. And they can be more reactive because they have more in the fields now. So you can have, you know, a plant's going to go the which always I. Anton Lutz is the brewer in Germany, and he talks about that first year, and basically you're putting all these hops out there, and you're just trying to kill them. He said, so a hop breeder needs to be a mass murderer, and I don't think Germans should ever say that. But they're going to have more things at a trial size. Like, so the next thing, it's going to go to single hill, and that's – so what – those sisters I showed you were all from single hills side by side by side. So there was only one plant of each of those. And then they'll go to, say, five hills or seven hills. So you could keep more things in your library that you're keeping track of all the time. So that what could be an eight-year period or whatever, all those plants in there may have gone through that period of shorter disease, and you have an idea what they're like. You still need that commitment of actually going to 5 acres. There were several experimental hops that looked pretty good last year when going to five, going to multiple acres, maybe 1 acre, not 5 acres, that are no longer going to be grown because that heat dome suddenly proved they were not going to make it. So they were eliminated.
Thanks.
Sure.
Thanks for the talk.
Awesome,
yeah. As always. I have a question. When you talked about the kind of like the American flavor, this tang or whatever the British would like to call it, and what they were getting back in the UK was mostly cluster, or like, so how much of that is it because of the genetic makeup, and how much is it of the growing? So is there any reference like to... like imports from the UK, so like brewers, Eastgate Goldings or whatever, grown in the US at that time, also exhibiting part of that flavor?
So that American Tang specifically was about Brewer's Gold.
Okay.
So you're talking about that one hop variety. And it's also described as black currant. So what they're describing is almost surely 4-MMP.
Okay.
So that you had that, and Brewer's Gold, you know, why does Citra, which the only thing American it has in it is Brewer's Gold BB1, and it clearly, it has free 4-MMP. Hops can do a lot of weird, they are sexually kinky, but creating that new thing, it has to have come from the BB1, and it makes sense that specifically that would be the American Tang. The rest, the unpleasantness, could be the same thing, that crossing. And we just don't know enough about that, how cluster evolved. and what was in upstate New York. But it was, those hops were just basically used for kettle.
Okay.
I'm not sure that answers the question. But
yeah, partially. I mean, what I'm trying to see is how much is it of genetics and how much it could be of terroir, because like Cascade now growing in Germany
everywhere
is completely different, and there's at least this kind of general trend that most of the hops growing in Europe tend to be more subdued respective to the same cultivar growing here.
So thiols, as you know, are sulfur compounds, and they are neutralized by copper. And all the winemakers in Europe are using copper in their fields. And the thought, and there's probably a crossover to the hops people, and they could quit using copper now, but it's in the soil. So that's certainly a factor. You're right, they are neutral. And is it just the climate, or are there other parts? But there's clearly a terroir affected by some of these things,
okay,
without a doubt.
Thank you, sir. And if you could say briefly, is there any work being done on hops to new cultivars or breeding programs where they're keeping a current hop flavor but trying to make it more disease-resistant or water-efficient?
Without a doubt, as much as they can, because they're true to seed. But you find, I mean, I'm not sure what it is, but so there are efforts to make, to keep Citra what you like in Citra. I don't know if they name it or they don't tell you, but where it yields better and it's more disease resistant. There are crosses of Citra at breeding facilities right now, for instance.
And the second part of that question was, will that then generate, on average, a new name? So here is a new name for a hop.
That's a marketing question. I mean, I don't know what the answer is. They sure would like to keep it the same because people use Citra, and I think there's a good chance they will.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
So just curious about this breeding process that you described, like going from sister plants to single hill and so on. And you mentioned that like sometimes they fail when they go to 5-acre stage. What changes from there and they get all the way there, and then when they go to 5-acre they fail? Or is it just the characteristics changes, or what happens at that point?
Well, by the time a hop goes to 5 acres, generally you think it's passed most of the test. But you do want to see that it remains true to type, that is, because they will drift a little bit over time. But the other thing you're doing, of course, is you're also establishing that brewers are going to use it. So it could get to 5 acres and then nobody buys it, or a few people. Like 630, I mentioned 630. 630 is up to 30 acres. That's a good amount of hops. But maybe it'll always remain at 30 acres, or maybe it won't be their effort for 30 acres. There's a little bit of arbitrariness because of the whim of consumers, I guess. We're set? Then thank you.